Good morning, this is AM, I'm Ashley Hall. Since Australia reopened its detention centre in Papua New Guinea 2 years ago, 129 people detained there have been determined to be refugees. A lawyer who's visited many of the refugees on Manus Island says rather than being resettled into the community, some of them are languishing in a transit centre waiting for the PNG government to decide what to do with them. Others remain in the detention centre. There are also claims that many asylum seekers who should have been declared refugees are having to wait while officials decide what to do. Simon Lauder reports.
Asylum seekers on Manus Island are taken from the detention centre to a transit centre if they're deemed to be refugees. The Director of Legal Advocacy at the Human Rights Law Centre, Daniel Webb, visited the transit centre on Manus Island this month. He says the first refugee was put there in January, and he's still waiting to be settled somewhere in Papua New Guinea.
And there is still no plan as to when and how these men will ever be transited out of the transit centre.
So he was determined to be a refugee 6 months ago. Why is he still in the transit centre?
Simply because the governments of Papua New Guinea and Australia have not developed a formal policy for the resettlement of refugees. As I understand it, there have been two draft policies that have been submitted to the PNG government. Both have been knocked back. In the meantime, whilst there is no policy in existence, these men continue to languish.
The Australian government says there are now 41 refugees in the transit centre and another 88 who are still in the detention centre. Daniel Webb says refugees are free to leave the transit centre, but they're not allowed to work.
We were told by the PNG government that a condition of Manus hosting the detention centre was that no refugees resettle there and no refugees work there. So for that reason, whilst these guys can't leave the island, they can't actually do anything on the island. They remain incredibly frustrated that they are just languishing there.
Is there any indication of when they'll be able to leave?
Absolutely none.
Mr. Webb says representatives of the PNG government confirmed no refugee has moved on from the transit centre and officials are reluctant to keep sending refugees there.
The PNG government said it's holding off. It's got many cases where people are what they call decision ready, ready for refugee status to be conferred, but they're refraining from granting that refugee status because they need to turn off the tap and stop transiting people into the transit centre when no one is transiting out.
And who is it who told you that?
The Deputy Chief Migration Officer from the Papua New Guinean government.
The Australian Director of Human Rights Watch, Elaine Pearson, also visited the transit centre recently.
You know, really the idea of the offshore processing was that these people would be able to move on with their lives, but in other countries, not in Australia. The Australian government's not really putting pressure on the PNG government to adopt the policy quickly.
AM asked the office of the Immigration Minister, Peter Dutton, how much it costs to house refugees in the transit centre and when the refugees will have access to a resettlement program. There are no answers, but a spokesman says refugee determination and settlement processes are matters for the PNG government.
Simon Lauder. A coalition of the nation's mental health organisations is imploring the Prime Minister and state and territory leaders to urgently introduce reforms to the sector agreed to in 2012. They say without a fully funded national mental health agreement and targets for improvement, the system will remain in crisis. From Canberra, Samantha Donovan reports.
In 2012, the Council of Australian Governments agreed to reform the mental health system. But 3 years on, those who work in the sector are still waiting. Frank Quinlan is the CEO of Peak Body Mental Health Australia.
To see mental health still suffering from inaction after so long, you know, 3 years now since the last COAG, it's very frustrating. We're very keen to see our First Ministers taking responsibility for that and taking action to address it.
More than 90 organisations, including Sane Australia, the Black Dog Institute, Lifeline and the Royal Flying Doctor Service, have written to the Prime Minister, the Premiers and Chief Ministers, urging them to act. Frank Quinlan says the sector wants the reforms COAG agreed to introduced.
COAG agreed that one of the first things that we needed to do was to set some targets for the performance of our mental health system, things like having a target around halving the nation's suicide rate. But sadly, those recommendations are still sitting on the shelf.
Frank Quinlan says a coordinated national plan also needs to become reality.
One of the things that governments recognised back in 2012 was that the arrangements that are in place between different levels of government are not working well. And that's been a long-standing problem where Commonwealth government actions and state government actions are uncoordinated. So back in 2012, COAG said they were going to overcome that. They were going to set up new governance arrangements, new accountability arrangements that would hold governments to account, but we're yet to see those arrangements put into place.
Why do you think the introduction of the changes has been delayed?
Look, I think it's a failure of long-term commitment to a very difficult and complex area of reform. And sadly, what I think we've seen more of a sort of quick fix solution. So an announcement here, a new program announced there. And while some of those programs are very welcome, on their own, no single program can really overcome the sorts of problems that we're experiencing in the mental health sector.
Mental Health Australia's Frank Quinlan says a national plan would make a big difference for people with mental health problems.
Many people who experience mental illness experience multi-level need for support. So it's not just the fact that they need to perhaps see a clinician and have the medical issues sorted out, but people who are experiencing long-term depression and other serious conditions will also be experiencing issues with employment and perhaps with housing and with other support in the community. So it's only when all of those programs are working together that we can hope issues like long-term depression will be overcome for the individual.
Mental Health Australia and the letter's other signatories are urging the Prime Minister, Premiers and Chief Ministers to discuss the reforms at their retreat in Sydney next week.
Samantha Donovan. This is AM Around Australia. It's 17 past 7. There's been a mass shooting of American military personnel in Chattanooga in the US state of Tennessee. Four Marines and a gunman were shot dead in what's been described as a brutal and brazen attack. Local officials say the attack is being treated as a case of domestic terrorism. Our reporter in the US, Nick Harmson, has more.
It took just half an hour for the gunman to wreak havoc in the city of Chattanooga. At 10:45 in the morning, he unleashed a barrage of bullets on a naval recruiting centre near the airport. His next target was another recruiting centre 15 kilometres away. There, he shot and killed four people before the gunman himself was shot dead. Andy Burke is the mayor of Chattanooga.
Today is a nightmare for the city of Chattanooga. Around 11 o'clock this morning, we had someone viciously attack at two different locations people who proudly serve our country. We do know that we have four individuals who were killed who are victims. We know that the shooter was killed at the scene as well.
The four victims were all Marines. Three other people were wounded, including a police officer who was shot in the foot while pursuing the gunman. He's in hospital in a stable condition. Gina Mule witnessed the first shooting from a nearby restaurant.
I heard loud noises, it was pow, 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 really loud, so I ran to the front of the building to see what was going on. And when I looked out, I just seen this guy, this white guy, in a drop top, silver Mustang, and he was pulled. I mean, he was literally like 10 feet away down, because they're right next door. He was pulled directly in front of the building. He was opening fire. He had a big, big high-power rifle, and he was opening fire on them.
Other witnesses reported hearing dozens, even hundreds of shots fired. A school, a hospital and a shopping centre were locked down. Bill Killian is the district attorney.
This is a sad day for the United States. These service members serve their country with pride and they have been the victims of these shootings. We are conducting this as an act of domestic terrorism.
FBI Special Agent Ed Reinhold was quick to point out the authorities don't yet know the shooter's motivations.
A disgruntled employee, for example, and I'm just using that example because he did not work at the facilities, but a disgruntled employee would not be necessarily an act of terrorism. But if he's motivated by, say, ISIL or somebody else, then that would be an act of terrorism.
According to several US news outlets, an anonymous senior federal official has identified the shooter as Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz, a naturalised citizen originally from the Middle East. Police have swooped on his house just a few kilometres away from Chattanooga. This is Nick Harmson reporting for AM.
An annual assessment of the world's climate has found that sea levels, ocean temperatures and greenhouse gases have hit record highs last year. The report by the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration examined contributions from hundreds of scientists in 58 countries. Deke Arndt is one of the report's editors. He's speaking here with Sarah Sedgie.
From a temperature standpoint, there were several records that fell. You know, overall, the temperature of the planet as a whole was at least nominally the warmest on record in the major data sets. And this was driven largely by the oceans, which really, in that context, kind of had the biggest year. The ocean surface temperature was the warmest on record. The average sea level around the globe was the highest on record. And the ocean heat content, which is a measure of the energy that ends up in the top 700 meters of the ocean, was also record high. So, and those are all big global averages. And, of course, from place to place and region to region and month to month, it wasn't necessarily the largest on record everywhere, every time. But on average, globally for the year, those values were record high.
What did the report find about the effect of warming in the Arctic?
You know, we've seen, and this report is just like an annual physical exam, you know, a big complete laboratory workup, you know, from the doctors. You know, a lot of what we see, we've seen in previous years. The oceans themselves particularly flared up this year. We do continue to see the Arctic being a crucible of change, you know, very rapid change in recent years in the Arctic. This year was not different from that. And that is across the Arctic region and across the different phenomena. So that's not just sea ice being near record low levels, but also the change in the vegetation status, the thawing and the warming of the permafrost up there. So really in the melting of glaciers and ice sheets in the Arctic, really profound changes continued throughout the Arctic.
And what did you find are the ramifications of the report's findings?
We do document some of the major events from 2014 from around the world. But yeah, clearly, you know, we study this and we invest people's time and careers in analyzing this kind of information because it's important. Ultimately, this is a report about the one planet that we all share and the one climate system that we all share. So it is important. These changes do affect people. Sea level rise affects, you know, the huge amount of the human population that lives along the coast, and many of those people don't have the resources to deal with sea level rise, especially over time. We live in an era of profound change, and change is costly, and this report is documenting the changes that we see, many of the changes that we are beginning to understand that we're going to have to deal with, and many of that we're already dealing with. So, yes, new records in anything in your life, you know, anytime something is the most extreme it's been, it does tend to have a cost associated with that. And so from that standpoint, of course, when we see the climate system moving in the direction that it's moving as rapidly as it is, it's one thing to say you're a kind of detached analytical scientist, but when sit and think, you know, this truly does impact people, and it impacts many people who may not have the resources to change as rapidly as the planet's changing around them.
Deke Arndt of the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration speaking to Sarah Sedgie. Australian tennis player Bernard Tomic has been arrested by U.S. police for refusing to leave a luxury Miami hotel. It's another blow for the young sports star, who only 2 weeks ago was stood down from the Davis Cup team for what was called unacceptable behaviour. Back then, Tennis Australia Chief Executive Craig Tiley said he hoped the 22-year-old would wear the punishment rather than go down a destructive path. North America correspondent Michael Vincent reports.
Bernard Tomic is the 25th ranked men's tennis player in the world. Today, he has a new number, Miami-Dade Corrections Inmate number 15013715. The 22-year-old was partying in the luxury W South Beach Hotel when neighbours complained about the music and loud noise. Miami Beach Police Department spokeswoman Vivian Thayer says hotel security went to the room just after 5 a.m.
When the hotel security repeatedly went up there to tell them, hey, listen, you need to turn on your music, he turned on your music. He refused, at which point, after the third time, the hotel security contacted police. The police then responded to his room, where they told him that he needed to evict the premises because of the fact that security guards had already dealt with him several times. The hotel no longer wanted him on the property.
Police say the other guests left the $10,000 a night penthouse suite without incident, but not the young Australian.
Mr. Bernard continuously refused to leave after being told several times, at which point he was told that if he did not leave after he had been trespassed, because the police officers on scene told him, listen, the hotel doesn't want you here. We are giving you a trespass warning. If you do not gather your belongings and leave, you are going to be arrested. He again refused and was then arrested.
So throughout this episode, was Bernard Tomic violent towards anyone?
Mr. Tomic was verbally abusive with the security staff, and once the officers responded, he physically refused to leave the premises. It is believed, according to the arrest affidavit, that he was under the influence of some type of alcohol.
So he was intoxicated?
Correct, he was intoxicated.
The tennis player was charged with one count of trespassing and another of resisting arrest. At 9:57, he was sent to the Turner Guildford Night Correctional Centre, where he spent the day. After a $2,000 bond was posted, he was released at 5:40 p.m.
The city of Miami Beach is a very attractive city with clubs and things like that. So sometimes when athletes, whether young or professional, come visit our city, sometimes they just don't make the best decisions.
The hotel wouldn't comment on the incident when contacted by the ABC. Miami-Dade Corrections and Rehabilitation says Mr. Tomic can expect a court summons within 3 weeks. This is Michael Vincent for AM.
The rise of Chinese investment in the Australian housing market has been lucrative for local real estate agents, and to lure millionaire investors, some developers are offering tailored portfolios to Chinese buyers. Real estate agents are even staffing offices in China to sell their properties. But the buying bonanza from China is adding to concerns that a dangerous property price bubble is building in Sydney and Melbourne. Bridget Brennan spoke with Sydney developers and agents overhauling the way they do business.
Waterfront properties at Mosman on Sydney's North Shore sell for millions of dollars, and these types of homes are proving extremely popular with Chinese buyers. Local estate agent Richard Simeon says his Chinese clients have particular requirements.
They have some set criteria which they prefer, being north-facing, they love large blocks of land, they love very good water views, not surprisingly. I sold two properties over $8 million in the last month to Chinese buyers.
In the last few years, Mr. Simeon has been dealing exclusively with Chinese buyers. Once they've purchased a house, some of his clients go to great lengths to ensure they'll have a happy home.
On a few occasions, I've had the Chinese buyers fly in their feng shui consultants from Asia. For them, obviously, it's a really spiritual consideration to the wealth and the happiness and well-being of the family, so they a lot take it very, very seriously.
Developers are also cashing in on the Chinese investment boom. David Milton is the Managing Director of Residential Programs at the property group CBRE.
We sell projects, and we found that with the number of Chinese that are looking in Sydney and visiting Sydney, we opened an office, a shop front in the middle of Chinatown, because most Chinese that visit Australia in Dixon Street sort of three or four times in their stay, so opening a shop front there, it works really well with actually advertising property and attracting them. So our sales team, we have in Sydney just over 70 salespeople. I think 25 of those speak Mandarin.
And Sydney's booming real estate prices haven't dampened demand. William Shen, the director of the Asian division at TGC Property, helps Chinese investors find a place in the Australian market. They tell him the return here is better than what they'd find at home.
The demand is still very strong, because they look at the property from a different angle, and because they compare China domestic investment returns to overseas buyers, those Chinese buyers, they saw, okay, it's still much better than in China.
Simon Henry is based in Hong Kong, where he runs Jui.com, a property site he founded which advertises Australian homes to the Chinese. He says increasingly local estate agencies are opening offices in Beijing and Shanghai to go direct to buyers.
For an agent or a broker to really start looking internationally, they have to really look at the barriers to entry which happen with an international buyer. Obviously, working with an American buyer is straightforward. Both parties speak English. But then if you're working with Asian buyers, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, quite often language barrier gets in the way. So yes, they definitely do have to change the way which they market and promote themselves internationally.
Simon Henry from Jui.com, ending Bridget Brennan's report. In finance, European stocks ended higher after the Greek Parliament voted to accept harsh new austerity measures. The European Central Bank is providing a special bridging loan to Greece and will increase emergency liquidity to Greek banks, although it's still unclear when they'll reopen. The Australian dollar is a little higher at just over 74 US cents. I'm Ashley Hall. It's 7:30.